Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back with another episode, actually a follow-up segment to an earlier episode we did. If you remember that double episode on the specialized USAR training that Joe Holly participated in, Dr. Joe was able to come on and talk with us about that. We were able to now talk about the planning that went into that event, and that's going to be exciting coming up here later on in this episode with a special guest. Before we, of course, get to the special guest, we have to get to the special co-host, and that means Sam Bradley. Hey, Sam.
Well, it's funny, Jamie, because the last time we recorded, I believe there was a hailstorm, and today I am boiling in 102 degrees, and I know Dr. Joe down there in Memphis is at 104. What's up with that, Mr. Weather Guy, Kyle Nelson?
Well, hey, Sam and everyone out there on Disaster Podcast land, meteorologist Kyle Nelson coming to you on the road this evening, doing a little bit of teaching in North Carolina this week. But yes, on the weather side of things, Sam, record-breaking heat there on the Front Range of Colorado today, as I'm sure you are feeling in full force. And that's all going to continue to slide east as the week goes on. So you have that to look forward to in the Midwest as well as in the Northeast later on this week as well. Looking back across this previous week of hazardous weather across the U.S., we had at least one severe weather report of either damaging wind, damaging hail, or tornadoes every day over the past week since we last recorded. So it's active weather season here. And the one of note, Sam, that I know we were going back and forth about a little bit was the two tornadoes that occurred in north central Colorado. So while we don't see the big tornadoes like we do out on the Great Plains and things, tornadoes can and do occur in the mountain environment. So that's what we have to look forward to here. So those can happen. But looking ahead weather-wise, again, that record-breaking heat in the Midwest and Northeast, as I referenced earlier. And also, don't forget about those drought conditions persisting and those fire weather conditions continuing to intensify in the southwestern United States. That's all I have. Back to you guys.
And thank you, Kyle. Yeah, they haven't.
Yeah, I was going to say, Kyle, be safe on the road there, and thank you for taking the time to chime in and call in to us and bring this segment. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Absolutely, Jamie. And again, folks, feel free to connect with me online or in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group to continue the conversation, but there's a great podcast ahead, so stay tuned for more.
Thank you, Kyle.
We'd miss you if you were here.
Thanks, guys.
But, you know, speaking of fire, I get a lot of news still out of Southern California, and they got a nasty one going on down there, and they're actually up north in Lake County. I'm sure our guest knows something about that, and we'll get to him in just a minute. But you've got to be warm down there in Memphis, Dr. Joe. What are you up to down there?
Oh, just sweating a little bit. It's typical summertime weather here. Hot and muggy during the day with the occasional intense springtime thunderstorm. So pretty normal stuff.
Yeah. Well, you can have the heat. You can also have the humidity.
But, you know, it is definitely been humid here.
Well, it won't stick around here for the heat for too long, I hope. But we have a good, very old friend of mine. I've known him since he was a pup. But he's now a firefighter and a USAR guy, and he does all kinds of stuff. And he had made a comment after listening to your podcast, Joe, about, you know, his effort. And our good friend, we'll give a shout-out to Linda Buell, who works for Oakland Fire. The two of them basically took the lead on planning your event. And I thought, wow, not only should they get credit, but we should talk about that, because I don't think we talk about planning all that much, which I know, Joe, is in your level of expertise. But, you know, in this one, you were an instructor and a participant, and so we'll look at that aspect of it. So David worked for Berkeley Fire. I assume, David, you're still the EMS guy over there?
That's true, yes. Currently assigned to the EMS division as the EMS captain.
So how did this – Alameda County, I got to tell you, in Northern California, it's like the exercise capital of the world, because they put on some of the biggest exercises I have certainly ever been involved with. But you know what, David, before we jump into that, what do you know about that fire up in Lake County? I'm sure you guys have been keeping track of it.
Yeah, from the county that I work in, Alameda County, in the East Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area, we've sent several strike teams Berkeley has sent an engine company up for the strike team. Last time I checked, it was 25 to 30% contained. Our weather's changed a little bit higher humidity, cooler nights. So we're making some progress on the fire. For us, it's fairly concerning to have this kind of fire behavior so early on in our fire season. Normally, we don't really get rocking and rolling until August. But our fire seasons have been starting early and then ending late all the way into November, sometimes December. So it's a little concerning.
Yeah, it seems like fire season is all year anymore, especially in California. There is no end. It just keeps going. So getting back to our topic, so this event was suggested, and I'm just going to throw out some generic thoughts because there's just so much to talk about here. How did you get involved in this? Did it come from the USAR side? How much was the fire department involved? And how does something like this get started? Because I know it has a lot to do with the training, the unique training that you guys do in Alameda County. Let's just start there.
So obviously USAR is near and dear to the East Bay with the Loma Prieta earthquake collapsing the Cypress structure. So it's something that is always at the forefront of our minds within our USAR family in the East Bay. I personally got involved with it actually through my father. I'm a legacy. My father was a fire chief in Oakland, and he was actually assigned as one of the planners and medical person for California Task Force 4. I originally got into the planning. I worked under Scotty McKinney out of Sacramento, who, as Joe would know, is just an amazing human being, amazing paramedic planner, trainer. And he started training several of us at California Task Force 4 to kind of begin to take over the planning as he was getting to retire. And last year was the first year in, I don't know, maybe Joe, what, 20 years that Scotty hasn't been involved in teaching a medical specialist class. I don't even know.
Yeah. I think that's correct. He had the gall to like travel to Peru or somewhere with his wife. So, you know, you just, I don't know about his dedication. I wonder sometimes. So.
Yeah. I think that was about the only way that we were going to drag him kicking and screaming to help us teach the class again. So that's kind of how we got into it. We were really fortunate. As Joe and you all discussed the last podcast, to have the NASA DART site at Moffett Field. And it's such a wonderful place to train, and it offers so many different things that we can do that, being very close, we were just able to kind of take on the class and maintain the training cache, which is a whole thing to be able to deliver the class, to have the equipment and supplies that you're going to play with. So that's kind of how I was involved. And Linda Buell, Captain Buell with Oakland Fire, became the lead planner, and I was her assistant in helping her put some pieces together.
Yeah, Linda's awesome. I've known her for a long time. And it's good to know your dad isn't slowing down. I taught with him for many years, too. Sounds like an old home week here. Before I want to get into the scenario, which Joe talked some what about, but how do you start? Where does the funding come from? Because you got to have that even to get started, right?
I'm sorry, I missed that last part of the question. Where did you ask about where we started?
Well, you know, when you're starting an exercise like this, obviously you have to have funding for people and equipment and mannequins and so forth. How does that work for an exercise like this?
Well, so we're really fortunate. As Joe mentioned, there's the curriculum that FEMA put together. They did a rewrite a few years ago. And the curriculum really does lay out, gives you pretty good guidance on your different skill scenarios, your skill stations, and then your scenarios building up to your night exercise. And it gives a lot of guidance. And that curriculum really does stand on the shoulder of giants who, you know, going back to the formation of the USAR system and individuals like Scott McKinney, like Joe, like Bruce Hagen, who, and Mark Stinson, who began to put it together. And then with the last rewrite really helps us organize it. So we have a fairly robust planning document. The next thing that we do, or Linda does, is looking for instructors from across the USAR system, really wanting to get people from the major places that train and teach USAR, from the East Coast, from the South, from the Midwest, and then from the West Coast, to get as much experience as possible within your instructor cadre. Because, I mean, you can have any kind of textbook, but if you don't have a well-versed, deep instructor cadre, the material is really tough to execute. And so that's like the next piece, is having that instructor cadre. In California, we're in a little bit of a unique situation, because we actually have a training cache that is ostensibly shared by the state. And we try to get as close to play as or practice as you're going to play as possible. So, as you heard, we had high fidelity canine mannequins. We were in rubble piles. We're building rubble piles, and the rubble pile builds are as close to lessons learned as possible. Some of the tunnels we used, not this year, but last year, were as much as possible like the Caribbean market from Haiti, from information we received from New York Task Force One, where it was a 40-minute crawl to get to your first patient. And it was low, and it was slow, and it was difficult. And so we try to reimagine as much as possible within reason for the students to kind of have those same kind of experiences. And with our training cache, it's what we have in the FEMA USAR cache. And it's about cache maintenance and kind of keeping that equipment as close as possible to the real thing. And that's where you start your foundation of building your classes. You have your curriculum, which we know we have. We start our instructor recruitment and having a diverse instructor pool, and then moving forward with maintaining the state training cache, which is a whole endeavor in and of itself. What we say in USAR is it's a lot of useless stacking and restacking of boxes, and that's what USAR stands for. But it's really a lot of cache management and making sure we have the equipment to be able to execute the class.
Yeah, I actually remember at one time our DMAT was sharing a warehouse with Task Force 4, and always hoped that they went out before we did, because it was easy to get to our equipment. That was a while ago. So, Joe, how did you get contacted on this? How did that work for you?
Actually, I got an email from Linda looking for instructors, and you know, that it just took off from there for me. It was the first time I'd actually had an opportunity to teach one of these classes on the West Coast. I've been done a lot of the East Coast stuff, but hadn't had a chance to do one out West. So I was very excited to join up and be part of the team. I'll have to say David has been very humble in their in accepting the kudos for an incredibly well put together class that was just dynamite at every level. So good job. Don't be humble, my friend. You did a great job.
Thanks.
So, Jamie,
it really is the instructors, like what Joe brought to the table and all of the other instructors. It truly is amazing. And I think that's something that the students feel, but sometimes can't really articulate, is what Joe brought to the table from his experience of an IST and all of his deployments really lend a sense of realism to the students. And we've all been in the class that has the incredibly dynamic instructor, and we've been in the class where you have a less dynamic instructor, and it really makes the class. So I think that if we can take credit for anything, it's recruiting a really great instructor cadre.
Well, you did a great job. And I know Joe always jumps on these opportunities, but he's in there digging around in the rubble with everybody else, and I respect that from him. So just to clarify, Joe, this was a USAR medical specialist class, correct?
That is correct, yeah. This was a FEMA-sponsored class.
And David, this is Alameda County's kind of a unique area in terms of putting on that class, correct?
That's correct. So there are several USAR teams that pull from one particular department for organization. Alameda County is California Task Force 4, which was the host of the class. We are multiple departments, with Oakland Fire being the host agency and the main coordinator. Alameda County has a history of building up these kinds of large-scale exercises. For instance, there's something called Urban Shield that Alameda County Sheriff's Department puts on. If you've seen Vice News, it's been in Vice News and it's been in several newspapers, and it can be kind of controversial from the law enforcement side, but from the fire and EMS side, it puts on some very realistic MCIs and active shooter scenarios and water rescue, urban search and rescue component, hazmat component. We sit kind of nestled right in the East Bay next to the Bay Bridge, so our target hazards are numerous and diverse. So we really understand the value of this training, because there's a really great likelihood that we're going to have to experience it. We've had active shooters in our area. We've had wildfires, earthquakes, water rescue on a regular basis. We have a major university that creates new chemicals every day that there's no such thing as the MSDS for yet, because nobody's written it. So we understand the need, and we do our best to train to it.
Ah, yes. You know, I miss it. It's pretty quiet out here in Colorado. Alameda County was where everything happened. So, Jamie, what are your thoughts so far?
Well, I was curious because Joe mentioned that he had been to trainings on the East Coast and was excited to go out and do something on the West Coast, especially in an area that is known for putting on such high-quality, large-scale events and training sessions. Joe, you know, what was the same, what was different about going here as compared to things you'd done in the past?
Well, I think it's just it's always interesting to see a new place. It's always interesting to get an opportunity to see how other folks do things. I learned a huge amount about, you know, how they like to organize things and put it all together. Again, kudos to these guys for just amazing, organization and flow for the course. This was actually the first time I've had an opportunity to be in a FEMA-sponsored course that was based on the new curriculum. And I was lucky enough to be involved in some of that revision with a focus toward trying to move some of that stuff online and then shorten up, you know, the amount of time that the students are spending there. And while I think we were successful in that, I think that it is a phenomenally intensive course that is a huge amount of stuff to cram into sort of 4 3/4 days. And it's exhausting for the students and the instructors. I'm not sure how completely it really does justice to how much there is to do. I mean, there's always something else to learn. There's always more that can be, you know, added to these courses. So it just sort of never stops.
This is a follow-up. Go ahead, David. Go ahead.
I would agree. I was on the working group, the FEMA working group, when we were first approaching the rewrite. And honestly, this is probably, I don't know, Joe, like a 90-hour class. And we're trying, you have to delete certain things and do other things and make choices about what curriculum you're going to deliver. And really, this could be a two-part class, one being a basic, which would probably be a four-day class, and then maybe creating an advanced class, which has been knocked around the USAR system for quite a while, because there's a lot of stuff that goes into it, like whole team care and taking care of your crews. For instance, when we went on the last hurricane deployments, there was a lot of medicine that had to happen for community medicine, of isolating people who had the flu who were getting all of the team sick while they were trying to do rescues.
Absolutely.
So there's all of those. Yeah, and you were there at the IST. There's a lot of those other pieces that, like Joe said, it's really tough to do justice to. And we try to get as much in as possible, because it's just, like I said, you could do 2 full weeks I don't think most people's bodies can handle two full weeks in a row, but definitely breaking it up into two classes is something that has been talked about and considered.
Jamie, more thoughts?
No, I just I'm really enjoying kind of thinking through the ideas of, you know, Joe, you do a lot of training, you know, through what you do with Paragon, and you know, talk about the experience. It sounds like David's pulling that, you know, pulling the perfect instructors for this class together really helped to do that and make it as high quality as it was. How hard is it to do that? I mean, there are only so many deployments that happen in a given time frame. Is what's the pool of available instructors like out there nationally that you can pull from, David? Is it hard to find people? You know, or is it just one of those situations that you just got to work through people's schedules and find who's available?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. There are only so many instructors out there who have the right skill set that you want as your instructors to deliver that quality product. And these people are not wilting flowers or daisies. I'm missing the metaphor, but they're all very busy. They're all highly engaged. They're all doing many, many things. And so their schedules are packed. You know, I can't even imagine what Joe's schedule looks like. So getting them out there for basically, I mean, the students come in on Monday or fly in Sunday, and then they start Monday. But the instructors are there starting Saturday, Sunday to do the building of the props. And to have them come out for that long of a period of time, it really is challenging. I think we started off with a 25 instructor wish list. And you invite people, and at times you get who you get instructors. We always have instructors that we never have had instructors out that we didn't want. I think it's a testament to Scotty and to Linda's planning. But there are a lot of instructors who are not just instructors, but are friends because they're such great instructors and people that we just can't get because they're busy, because they're key individuals within their communities and their departments.
I can well imagine. Oh, my God. Well, obviously, you were able to fill the bill, so that worked out well. But, you know, you talk about some of the mannequins, like canine mannequins. So these guys not only were taking care of patients, they were taking care of each other, and they were taking care of search dogs. So I'm kind of curious, we talked a little bit about it, and Joe, you can jump in on this too. What kind of mannequins were you using? And I know I've seen some of the very realistic mannequins, but what else did you have in that cache, David?
So the mannequins we used were called FX mannequins, and many of you have gone to EMS Expo and have seen the high-fidelity mannequins. Unfortunately, we do have to be careful when we get mannequins because you never want to bring anything into the pile that you're absolutely not confident that you're okay breaking. And breaking a several thousand-dollar mannequin can be tough on the budget. So this is kind of like we talked about planning. How do you plan for this? And it's kind of a continual planning process. We know we're going to do this training every year for the last several years. And so what we do is, as our current cache of equipment expires, we save it because we know we're going to use it for training. So we never throw away a box of expired 1 in 10,000 Epi because we know that we're going to need it for the class. And so we maintain a very, very large, robust training cache. For instance, our amputation kits, we know they're going to expire. So we build that into our regular budget, and we save it because we know we're going to be practicing amputations in the hole. And we don't care if we break it because we know that that's what it's designed for. And I think lastly that we are very fortunate that our task force has a commitment to really high quality training. And so that commitment equates to dollars in finance. So when we tell our program manager, hey, look, like we really need to get these FX mannequins that are going to cost $1,200 per mannequin, and we're only going to use them for 2 days. He goes, is that what you really need? We say yes. And he's like, absolutely, go for it. If that's what these guys need to train the way that they're supposed to, then let's go ahead and do it. And I think that's a really important key part for us, is that kind of support and that thoughtfulness, that mindfulness that, you know, what we're going to do with our expired cash for the next 3 to 4 years.
Well, it's great to continue to get some use out of that, and I know how realistic they are, so that's pretty neat. Joe, are there any of the mannequins that stick out, or some of the training pieces as you went through with your guys?
Well, I'll have to say it's the first time I've had an opportunity to really get engaged with the canine simulators. And I really had to do a double take on some of those things. They are quite impressive for everything from intubation to gastric lavage to IV starts and all that sort of stuff. So I was quite taken with how good those things were and very impressed overall with the quality of those mannequins. And they are not, you know, inexpensive, easy toys to bring out into that environment by any means.
So, David, can you kind of give us an idea of the scenario and which agencies were involved?
So the scenario was a structural collapse, and we were coming in 48 hours after the initial incident. We were relieving the first responders in the local agencies coming in. Search had multiple hits in multiple areas, and we received a brief, and it's run like an actual incident when you're going to get your brief, your tactical action plan brief from when you're getting ready to go to work. So then depending on how many volunteer victims we have, we tend to use live victims within our class. We can get them for free, so that's always the best price. And there's a level of realism just the way the body moves going through the tunnel. So we get about three victims per division, and we ran six divisions. And each division has a different tunnel, and it has a team assigned. And the teams are 6 to 7, sometimes 8 people per team, mixed with physicians and paramedics. And that gives us the ability to run different kinds of scenarios, whether it be within that overall night exercise, whether it be amputation, treating crush. And believe it or not, in my particular division, I did a very simple cardiac chest pain. And Joe was my doc, and it was, can you do a basic cardiac assessment when you're distracted because you're in a deep, dark hole and you're hot and you're sweaty and you have a mask on? And that's kind of some of the scenarios and the overall scenario and some of the smaller pieces that we had to it.
So what's the answer, Joe? Can you do that in the tunnel upside down with your mask on?
You kind of have to.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly makes things interesting. You know, I think Patrick talked a little bit about that last week with just the challenges of trying to do the most routine stuff in a very unroutine, if that's really a word, situation. And then, you know, then you complicate that by adding on, you know, we talked about a pericardial or a cardiac tamponade last time, and you know, the doc sort of challenging, and even I think his own skills, like, on, you know, am I really seeing what I'm seeing here, and what am I going to do about this in this environment, et cetera. So it'll test you in lots of ways. Of course, that's the whole point. So
David, from beginning to end, how long does it take to plan this event?
Yeah. So the way it works, at least for Linda and I, is that we take July and part of August off, and then the second week of August, we start talking again. And we start, like, I just finished some of the after-action stuff, and we start, do we have the funds to do it? Okay, let's rehab by cash, probably in September. Let's look at EMS Expo to see what else is out there, you know, come the fall, early winter, you know, mannequins, equipment, and then heavy planning, like in that first week of December, of like, hey, do we get the permission from FEMA? Do we get the funds? Is it listed in the general memorandum? Okay. Now, Jay, start peppering, doing soft touches to instructors, like, hey, you know, first week of June, something you might be interested in. And then we normally meet once a month for January, February. March, we'll start meeting 2 to 3 times a month, start really in-depth. April, it's full tilt, and May, it's full tilt, and organizing, securing housing and food, and interacting with DMAT or CalMAT. That CalMet crashing starts primarily in February and then ramps up, and we normally have a couple of face-to-face meetings, a couple of site visits, and then we'll have a meeting, a phone conference call once a week in April, May, to solidify all the different pieces. And those conference calls run anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour and a half. And then really, really intense last week of May, and then obviously in the class in June, and then that's our planning cycle.
Oh my God, pretty almost a year-round thing. And of course, when you're changing curriculum and updating things and all of that in the process, I can only imagine.
Yeah, it's kind of always in the back of your mind that, like, you're in the USAR warehouse and you're going through stuff and somebody's like, oh, this is bad, let's throw it away. And you're always kind of like, oh, no, I need that, I can save that. Or that CAD is broken. It's like, well, it may be broken for the street, but it's not USAR broken. I can duct tape that together and make that work. And so it's one of those things that's always kind of filtering through your brain. Can you use it for the class? Because the class is such a monster to put on.
Yeah, we can bury this one. Yeah, you're a lot like me in that respect. Joe, you made a comment offline to me that I think is really valid, because the idea, he's mentioning the CalMet, which is the state disaster response team, which is near and dear to my heart because I helped create it, as well as your local folks that are involved, your local agencies, and your federal assets, and the benefit to having them work together, because gee whiz, if there is an incident, that's the way this is going to work. And obviously, with active shooter and a lot of the stuff that's going on, we kind of been forced into that alliance, but it's a good thing, don't you think?
Was that for Joe, or is that for
unmute
me?
That's for Joe.
Yeah, sorry. I forgot to unmute. I did. But yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed that part of it. I think that we don't have an opportunity to do that frequently enough, either in the field or in our training. And, you know, the idea of sort of combining the best of a couple of really powerful federal assets into a combined entity really makes a lot of sense. And, it's just the right way to train. It's the way to bring everybody together.
So, David, your thoughts on that? But I have to tell you, Jamie loves your phrase, it's not USAR broken. I think we're going to hear that again.
Okay. And my
that's special.
Yes, please. I think I probably stole it from somebody else. I think, like Joe said, it is immensely important, because when a USAR team deploys, it's a fairly big incident, and we're going to be interacting. So there's major impact to the local infrastructure, and we're going to be interacting with other federal assets. And so having that experience is really, really valuable. We experienced it last winter with the Nunes fire, where we had ambulance strike teams under, I think, a federal contract. They came in and had to evacuate a couple of hospitals and had really challenging things that were happening. It happened in California. There's been a really big move on the state USAR side, the SUSAR side. And so interacting those local or the smaller state assets that then are going to dovetail into the federal assets on a major disaster, that will then have to have your DMAT or CalMAT teams that are going to need to be supporting local hospitals and infrastructure and clinics, I think is really, really valuable. And when we pull somebody out of the rubble pile, you just don't go, okay, you're gone, unless you're in a place like Katy. You're going to transfer them to potentially definitive care. And it's really important. I think next year we're also going to try to add another wrinkle, which is an ambulance strike team component to it, to add another level of complexity, because I think that would be the next logical step in a major disaster, is that ambulance strike teams would be integrated to evacuate people out of the impact area. Depend on how much of a glutton for punishment we are in the planning process, if we're able to execute or not.
Well, it started there in California, so that would make perfect sense. I remember right after that scenario was created with the ambulance strike teams, we did, I think, one big exercise out there, but you know, then, of course, right after that was Katrina, where they actually did have a practical exercise. So, yeah, it's a great component. So as we wind down here, Joe, any final thoughts on all of this?
Well, I just, you know, kudos on all the folks that pulled off a really amazing educational experience in every sense of the word, and for making me feel at home there and let me be a part of it. I learned a lot from how they did things. But I really think especially the integration component was very much near and dear to me, and I look forward to doing the next one with them.
David, you're a rock star.
Joe, your family now, you got to come back.
Excellent. Yeah, I look forward to it.
You're not getting away from them now, Joe. But yeah, and Linda, I can't say enough about her. I just know her personality, and she's so intelligent and just such a good person. So, and I know that
absolutely
Joe thought highly of her as well. So say hi to her when you see her and let her know. We'll send her the link to this podcast. She wants to hear us say good things about her. But any final thoughts from you, David, on this whole process? And you're probably jumping into the after action phase, right?
Yeah. I just had that the first conference call in the after action yesterday. You know, like most things in EMS and medicine and disaster, it's the quality of the people that we interact with, their heart, their intelligence, their dedication, that makes this class what it can be and what it is. And we, like I said before, we're standing on the shoulders of giants who have come before us, and we do our best to live up to their legacy. And it's exciting and it's fun. And when I said, you know, you're part of the family now, it's true. It becomes a family. And I know that there's been huge intangibles for us that when we deployed to last hurricanes, it was like, oh, hey, how are you doing? You know, when you're at the convention center or the military base waiting to go operational while you're just staging. And it's something that we truly have a passion for, and we love. And we love the people that we work with. We love the people that we teach, because they're going to be our partners on the next deployment.
Yes, and it's entirely possible all three of us could end up in the same place sometime with our various teams. One never knows. So we'll have to get you back, David, because there's just so many different things we could talk about. But I'm glad you brought this topic up, and it's one we haven't talked too much about. I don't know about you, Jamie, but I certainly learned a few things.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, this has been very interesting to kind of hear somebody else talk about the importance of really bringing in the best, most experienced and most qualified people to pass on that experience to other people that are coming in as students. And Joe, you know, we talk about this all the time when we talk about what you guys do with Paragon Medical Education Group, the experience that you call your training events. You know, you call it the experience because it is about having those type of people, the people who've had boots on the ground, you know, been in the middle of the mess and seen everything that's happened in their deployments, so that they can bring that experience to the students. And you know, it's interesting to hear the fact that you are going out and continuing to learn and continuing to participate in the field so that you can bring that information back.
Well, you're right, Jamie. I mean, we call it that for a reason, and it is because it's all about incredibly experienced people. That's what makes the difference, and, you know, I think it holds true no matter who the sponsor of the training is in every different way.
So if folks want to bring Paragon in for a training event and they want to find out more about what you guys do, I always lately have been talking a lot about, you know, they just need to reach out to you and talk to you because they don't know what exactly it is you can do for them and how broad and customized an event can be to cater specifically to their needs, their budget, and everything else. Where can they get a hold of you?
Well, they can reach us at ParagonMedicalGroup.com or on Facebook under the same name. You can also reach us anytime through the Disaster Podcast. And we look forward to talking to people. You're right. It's a very customizable and unique experience. And I think that's part of what makes it so cool is that it's always something different.
And again, thank you for your continued support of the show. And, you know, here we are coming in, what, our fifth year here, Sam, and just doing a lot of good things and bringing people, amazing people like David on the show. And David, thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for having us on, having me on, I should say.
Sam, where can folks find you?
You can find me in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 on the disasterpodcast.com website and on our Disaster Podcast Facebook page, which is growing and growing, as I've noticed. And I think we're in the middle of our fifth year, Jamie. We're moving in on six.
It just keeps flying by, doesn't it? It's great. And just to put a shout out for our friend Kyle Nelson, you can find him on Twitter at WX Kyle Nelson in most social media platforms out there, including Twitter and other places. Look Kyle up if you want the latest in updates in disaster weather information and meteorology and social media and disaster planning. He is a really great resource for all of those things, and I urge you guys to check out and follow him there. As far as me, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations. So friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me there. And always, you can find me over at our Facebook group. So search for Disaster Podcast. Ask to join the group. We'd love to have you come in. We post our episodes there. We have a lot of our guests come in and join us there and answer questions that are posted on their episodes. Bring in other resources and share that stuff there. And David, you know, I don't know if you're available to, you know, interact with us on that platform, or if you have another way folks can reach out to you if they want to maybe pick your brain about putting an evolution together in their area.
If I could lean on Sam a little bit to help facilitate that, I really don't have much of a social media presence.
No, that's perfectly all right. I just wanted to give you the opportunity in case you did. But you know what? Sam knows how to get a hold of David. So if folks want to reach out to Sam, she'll get the questions answered for you. And if you need to be put in contact, she'll take care of that as well. David, you're just it's great to have you kind of talk about the back end of one of these events and kind of give us an idea of just the year-long planning process and all of the things that went into putting this event together after we heard about it in that double episode of all the things that happened and the experience that Patrick had and Joe had while they were there participating. So thanks again for sharing all that with us.
And thank you very much. It was really interesting to hear from the student's perspective after the class. And it really was gratifying to hear that he had such a positive experience.
So, Sam, we talk about dealing with the patients, but even planning for things like patient mannequins and things like that in a disaster setting or disaster training setting, it isn't like you do in a regular CPR class in a hospital, right?
Exactly. And these guys work so hard, you know, so much of the year, either putting these events together or participating in them. You know, the public should know how much work goes into this. It's just not like you call 911 and get a USAR that hasn't trained or interacted with people for quite some time since the last disaster. These guys do this, you know, all the time, plus their dedication to their fire departments, their ERs, everything else that they do. And everybody I know has always got their thumbs in any number of different pies. So I really hope people can appreciate their efforts a whole lot more. And this being a medical specialist course for USAR, I think that's really important because the skills that they have to do couldn't be more complicated. And it's a perfect example that, you know, disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.